It's my privilege tonight to introduce Andy Dobson, professor from Princeton, who is on his first visit of hopefully several as an A.D. White professor at large at Cornell. My name is André Dont. I am a professor in the Lab of Ornithology and in the Department of Ecology and Evolutionary Biology. And together with Kristin Schuler, we co-host Andy, she for the part in the vet school, me for the rest of campus. One of the things you have to do when you nominate somebody for a professor at large, an A.D. White professorship, is to explain that the guy is absolutely phenomenal. Now, with Andy, that's not a problem. But you also have to convince your colleagues that the broader Cornell community would be interested in his visit. So to do that, you ask your colleagues to write letters, and you put all the letters together, and you send them to the Penny, A.D. White professor, administrator. And then the committee decides, and in case of Andy, actually it seemed to not be quite easy. He was unanimously nominated, and then the board of trustees appoint him. And it's a six-year appointment, so he'll come back probably another two times, I hope. Now, rather than enumerate all his multiple achievements, like more than 30 papers in Nature and Science, an H index of 82, thing like that, let's not worry about that. I just want to read you a couple of sentences from nominations from the support letters that I received when we nominated Andy. One colleague said, he's a superb scientist, an outstanding teacher, and one of the most dynamic members of the large academic community I've ever known. The breadth of his research is outstanding and almost without parallel in the ecological community. This clearly points to his unquestionable potential to have large collateral benefits for the Cornell academic community should he be given the opportunity to serve as an A.D. White professor. I was very happy that this colleague underlined the fact that he's a dynamic person, because one of the questions you have to answer when you nominate somebody is, will the guy be physically up to it? So I said yes. Another letter said, he's without question the single best person I can think of for this honor. A very distinguished scholar who powerfully crosses fields that are of great excitement and potential for scientists here at Cornell, from modeling to disease ecology to parasite biology to conservation. And he's a great communicator. So, ladies and gentlemen, I give you Andy Dobson, a longtime friend, an outstanding scientist, and a great communicator.
Andy. Thank you. Thank you very much, André, for that very kind introduction, and my apologies to all those people who had to perjure themselves writing that letter, those letters. It's a great honor to be here. Cornell has always been a very special place for me. I've visited often over the last 25 years, and I've found every visit stimulating. This week has been absolutely superb. I have talked to so many brilliant and exciting people that I'm not really sure I'm physically up to be able to give this lecture, but I hope to get through it. What I'm going to talk about is sort of different from my sort of other part of me that works on diseases. I'm going to talk about stuff that I've been doing with friends and in the background because I felt it was important to do. It's still science, and I hope it's got chunky bits of science in it, but it's something just do because I felt it was important to do it. It's been done with predominantly to two absolutely amazing women scientists, Joyce Poole, who I met when we were both postdocs together back in the 1980s, I guess that was, and with Katarzyna Nowak, who has been a postdoc with me over the last few years. We're going to talk about these animals, much bigger than the parasites I usually work on. Am I?
I'm just
going to
make a slight adjustment to your mic. Okay. So you sound a lot better and crisper to everybody.
Okay.
Okay.
Am I better and crisper? Okay, cool. CRISPR's not that thing we were talking about. Anyway, don't any of the microbiologists get excited. We're not going to talk about CRISPR. This is a beautiful male elephant who's named Little Male. He was little when he was born, about 44 years ago. This picture, taken about earlier this summer, he is in his prime. He is 44 years old. He's beginning to be able to get matings. He is ready to make major contributions to the future of the elephants at Amboseli, where he's lived since he was born. He was shot 2 weeks ago. He had gone out of the park, raided the crops of a farmer. The farmer had come out to protect his crops. The farmer wasn't as big as the elephant. The elephant turned around, swiped him with his trunk, killed the farmer. The Kenya Wildlife Service people felt, this elephant is now a man killer. We should go in and kill him. So they just went straight in, shot him, didn't collect the ivory or anything, just left the body there. And that instantly sort of epitomizes the sort of moral dilemmas we face when we look at elephants and that people have been looking at, I've been looking at for the last 25 years. How do we do this calculus of what's the value of an elephant life versus the tusks that are attached to it versus the human lives or the land to grow crops on? And that's going to be the underlying theme of much of what I talk about today. So tragically, little male will no longer play much of a future in this story. So I'm going to divide the talk into three sections. Initially, I'm going to talk about work that's largely stuff that I collaborated with, but they did most of the work, on the demography and social organization of African elephants. And that was part of a long-term study set up by Cynthia Moss and Joyce Poole at Amboseli, with Cynthia focusing on the females, Joyce focusing on the males, and then Phyllis Lee, Keith Lindsay, and then more recently, many, many Kenyan students working with them to understand these elephants. Partly because if we're to look at the interaction between elephants and the ivory trade, the second part of the talk, we need to understand how elephant populations work. And they work in very complex and beautiful ways. So I'll then talk a history of the ivory trade over the last 200 years, condensed down to about 2 minutes, and then talking about what we understand of the interaction between the ivory trade and elephants, and what's the future for that over the next 20 years. Finally, I'll go in a slightly overlapping direction to talk about the international body that overlooks trade in elephants, and in fact, trade in all species, CITES, and ask, how good a job does CITES do with elephants, and how good a job in general does it do with the trade? And then a curious thing, how much do elephants actually interfere with the way that CITES works? And that's all work I've been doing very recently with Kate Katarzyna. Okay, this is the initial cast of characters, people who've been working at Amboseli or with Kenya Wildlife Service. Joyce is in the front there, Cynthia, Ian Douglas Hamilton, Richard Leakey, Soila, Katie, a wonderful bunch of people. Richard, when he took over Kenya Wildlife Service, did something that many people thought was extraordinary. It was on the poster I noticed you'd use for the lecture. He collected all the ivory that had been confiscated from poachers, put it in Nairobi National Park, and set fire to it. And the Economist said, you must be mad. You've just burnt at least $5 million in 1988 dollars that could have been sold and used for conservation. And Richard said, it was worth doing this because it would stop, it'll make the message that we would rather burn this than have people kill our elephants. Now, what was the logic behind that? Well, let's go, first of all, to this wonderful place, Amboseli, in the shadow, or the reflected shadow of Mount Kilimanjaro. The elephants there have been studied since 1972 by Cynthia, and then Joyce starting in 1974. They know every individual in the population. So you can look at the numbers, follow everybody's history through time. The population has steadily been increasing because it's relatively well protected from poaching. There's variation in that increase. Some years it grows quite quickly, some years it grows more slowly. So there's variation in the annual rate of increase, but on the average, it's growing at about 2% a year. As I say, every elephant is known as an individual. You can do that from the shapes of their ears, the various tears give them away, the shape of their tusks, whether their tusks are broken, even the sort of circles around their eyes, once you get your eye in, allow you to identify them as individuals. So everybody's known and you can follow them through time. You can age them once they die by looking at their teeth. Unlike you or I, elephants have 5 sets of teeth that come through their jaws, the different little bits, the little plates fission to give these huge teeth that gradually wear away as they eat woody and grassy vegetation. So ultimately, life expectation in elephants is determined when their last set of teeth fall out. Once you've got no teeth to chew anything with, you eventually just chew your jaw away and drop dead. A small proportion of elephants ever reach that age. Oops. Now, the other vital thing, and many of these slides have been customized at great expense to the era when I actually first drew them, the one thing that defines elephants is their tusks. Obviously, we wouldn't have an ivory trade if elephants didn't have tusks. Tusks grow at a different rate in males and female elephants. Female tusks grow slower and settle down at a sort of average size of about 8 to 12 kilograms. Male tusks just keep growing and growing and growing and growing. As I'll show you, the biggest set of tusks ever taken. This graph goes up to 50, but they can be easily two or three times that, 50 kilograms. You can also plot on that graph the age at sexual maturity, which again is very different for male and female elephants. Females can become sexually mature at about 8 to 10. They usually have their first calf at about 10. Males don't really become reproductively active until 20. And as I'll show you, it takes much, much longer than that before you're an acceptable male to mate with any female. So we can look at elephants. The other thing about them is you can age the ones you can't get the teeth on by looking at the height of the shoulders. Now, you could rush out with poles and try and measure them, but you'd end up like that guy who went out to protect his crops. So what Phyllis Lee worked out is you could take photographs of elephants, wait till they've gone away, and then rush out and take a photograph of a pole, superimpose the picture of the elephant on the picture of the pole, and then you can measure its height and shoulder height. You can also measure the size of its footprints, look at those and get very accurate estimates of age. You can also show that elephants die relatively slowly. The survival curves, the females actually survive better than males. Once that testosterone starts kicking in, as with humans, it increases the mortality rates of the males much more than the females. Age at first reproduction, as I say, 10 to 12, but some females may not start reproducing until they get to 20. Interbirth interval is about 4 years. If you lose your calf when it's little, you can breed a little bit earlier, but it's not exactly 4 years. If conditions are not right, it can take much, much longer. And females continue reproducing right through their life. This is age-specific fecundity against age for females. It goes up, peaking at about age about 12, and then stays roughly constant until you're well into your late 50s and early 60s. This then sets up the social system for elephants, because elephants live in this amazing matriarchal society. If you're a female elephant, you live with the same females you were born with for the rest of your life. This is a female with her most recent calf standing behind her, the one that's 4 years older than that standing beside her, the one that's 4 years older than that standing beside her. They're all females. The one at the back is her sister with her calves of different ages. So you live in this hugely structured society of females that kick the males out once they get to about a bit obstreperous, starting being sexually active. They kick them out at about age 15, 16, and they go off and live in little male groups by themselves. So a female's life is essentially you have a lowest probability of it to be about 10. You have a sort of increasing survival probability and starting having calves between 10 and 20. You then have a very good chance of surviving through until you're 50. And then you get older and your mortality rate begins to increase a little and your probability of having calves declines a little. As I said, we can age them. Males are different. This is a completely different beast. This is a huge animal. This is an elephant appropriately called Beach Ball. He is about 2 to 3 times the size of those females. Huge tusks. He spends a lot of time being solitary, but once in a while he gets together with other elephants in a social system that reminds me of Glasgow on a Saturday night when I grew up. Essentially, whenever male elephants find other male elephants, they want to go and beat the pulp out of each other. And they will only fight an elephant that's roughly the same size as themselves. If an elephant's much smaller, he knows he's going to lose the fight and runs away. So the older you get as an elephant, the bigger you get, the better chance you have of winning fights. And the prize for winning the fights is, of course, matings with females. If you look at male reproductive success against age, and this is sort of curiously, there's this word at the bottom, must, male elephants go into a thing that's the male equivalent of estrus, a period of heightened reproductive activity when they're very, very attractive to females. They will leave a sort of trail of green slime behind them. Any female who smells that green slime will turn and follow it until she can find that male if she's in estrus. And there are advantages. As you get older and older, your number of females you can mate with can be up in the several hundreds a year. So the prizes of getting old and winning all those fights are huge for that period of time that you're the biggest and meanest elephant on the block. And indeed, you can see that in the slightly more confusing side. These are days of the year on the x-axis, wonderful work that Joyce put together. Age of elephants. The oldest males in must, this period of heightened activity, at the time of year when most females are in estrus. All the younger males don't get into must then. They're sort of essentially suppressed out of it by those older males. So those old males get most of the mating. And indeed, what happens if a female finds a male in must, she will go and mate with him. She then makes a call that elephants don't make at any other time, and this excites all the other females to come over and find out what's happening, and they will then hang around with that female until he's guarded her for 2 days. They will then be in estrus and ready to mate with him. So that's a beautifully complicated mating system. It also creates a huge reproductive skew. It means the maximum number of calves that a female could produce over the duration of her lifetime is about 8, one every 4 years or so. A male over 20 years can easily sire 50 to 100. 50 is the maximum recorded, but you're not seeing all of the matings. And as we begin to do the genetics, we realize that some males have been having many, many more than that. There's also a second curious effect, that there's this interaction between rainfall and female fecundity. Africa's famous for having years of droughts, years of rain. This is what the rainfall looks like at Amboseli, some really good years, some bad years. This is the proportion of females giving birth. And plainly, you can only give birth in a year when you're not carrying a calf around. If we superimpose those two graphs, years when it's been 2 years earlier, lots of rain, is when lots of females conceive and lots of calves are born. Those calves are all living in a group with their mothers, their sisters, their grandmothers, and they're all mated by the same male, which is a curious mating system, that you and your mother can have offspring by the same male who won't live long enough for the offspring he sired with you to be around when he's died. So there's no inbreeding, but you have this curious thing that you're hugely related to the females you live with, and you're also related by sharing the same male genes. And that's, I think, curious, because if you play around with the maths of that, it creates a sort of stochastic haplodiploidy, something that's similar to the mating systems we see in the social insects, that you are extra related with the elephants you're actually living in the same group with. And does that contribute to making elephants super social? We don't know yet fully, but I find that quite an extraordinary result. So why did Leakey light that bonfire, having given you that background on elephant social systems? Let's disrobe mildly and move to the bonfire's a bit warm up here, so I will, okay, it's okay. To get to that answer, you have partly he went because he spent time at Amboseli, and Joyce and Cynthia were explaining the social system to him. This is someone from a family of people who were originally famous for looking at early human origins. He said, this is extraordinary. I mean, what does this tell us about how human societies evolved on the savannas, this switch from a matriarchal society to a patriarchal society? If you look back, a wonderful work by E.J. Milner-Gulland, John Beddington, and Bob May, they tried to reconstruct the history of trends in ivory sales back to 1810. Before that, ivory was mainly carved in India. Africa didn't really open up for ivory until the end of the sort of 18th century, about 1810s. the ivory that was carved was usually one tusk carved by several generations of a family and then passed on to whoever the ruling person was in that part of India where they lived. Once we get to the 1810s, two things happen that massively increase the demand for ivory. One is billiards and a demand for billiard balls. And elephant ivory is just the right texture for billiard balls. You can carve it into circles and have perfectly hard balls that don't shatter when they bash into each other. The other tragic thing is we have to lay the blame at Mr. Beethoven and Mr. Schubert for having pianos that were built with a steel frame and much cheaper to build than the wooden ones where you needed such high quality wood that they kept warping. Once you've got steel frame pianos, there's a huge demand for ivory for the keys, because when you play a piano with ivory, the sweat from your fingers is absorbed by the ivory rather than getting all slidey if you're playing a sort of plastic key piano. So you see this steady increase in demand for ivory, which continues through into the 20th century. And indeed, if we look at what was going on in Kenya, the volume of ivory through the 20th century is relatively constant, superbly driven by the price of ivory. Suddenly, when we get to the 1960s, and we go off the Bretton Woods Agreement, go off the gold standard, all sorts of other things start driving the commodities market, ivory becomes a much more important commodity, the price jumps up, and that hugely increases the demand for ivory. You can actually look, again, this wonderful thing that EJ and John Beddington did, at how has that demand for ivory affected the growth rate of elephant populations. And you can show that elephants have been steadily declining since about 1810. Now, I'll worry that everything we've seen this century has had a huge impact on elephants. That's certainly true. As I'll show you, it's probably reduced them by at least 50, 60%. From 1810 till about 1970, they reduced by about 90 to 95%. So before the present crisis began, we probably already lost 90% of the elephants we had 2 years ago. This is a classic graph, this one, a real wonderful vintage. This is what was going on in ivory in the 1970s, right up until Joyce and Cynthia had that conversation with Richard. Global sales of ivory are going through the roof. The numbers are actually beginning to crash down, which is a classic example of an overexploited population that's about to collapse. Any fisheries biologist would look at that and says, that population is in deep trouble. You're running out of stocks of elephant. So that's when Richard said, it's time to stop this all happening. Let's light this bonfire. And indeed, it reflected a poaching wave of professional poachers who'd been spreading across Africa. We went and dug out all the data from this from various sources, but starting around 1979, each dot is a source of an or each dot represents ivory from the country in which those dots are placed. You can see through time, 1979, 1980, 81, 82, a wave spreading down through Africa that eventually, when that bonfire set in 1988, stops. And that tells you two things. Most of the poaching was very organized professional gangs getting the ivory out and taking it to markets. It also says that all of the talk from South Africa and Botswana and the Southern African nations about being super efficient at stopping poaching is complete nonsense. The professional gangs of poachers never got there, and they still haven't really got there. At the moment, they're focusing on rhinos because they're even more valuable than elephants. But Southern Africa has not yet experienced a major ivory crisis, as I'll show you. So let's go back to this. How does the poaching work? And what does that natural history we learned about elephants tell us about how poaching might work? Because if you're a poacher, do you just go and shoot any elephant? Or if you want to sell the ivory, you should go for the ones with the biggest tusks. And how's that going to affect the social structure of elephants? Well, let's look at that. These are the largest tusks ever taken. These used to be at the entrance way to the Mweka Wildlife College Moshi in Tanzania. They're much taller than this guy, and this is quite a tall guy. They weigh 120 kilograms. This was a massive elephant shot on the slopes of Mount Kilimanjaro by a professional hunter in about 1918. Massive tusks. If you look, and this is work that Joyce put together that got me involved in this in the first place, if you look at the average size of tusks entering the trade in the 70s and 80s, the average size goes from 10 and drops down to 4 kilograms. Those are not huge elephant tusks that are being taken. And indeed, if you look at that in terms of that graph, as I said, the biggest tusks would be way, way up here, the ones that are really valuable. By the time we go into the 80s, the average tusk size is down here. And that's representing either very, very young males, perhaps too young to even be sexually active yet, or females who are in their prime reproductive time. You can look at some of the geographical patterns in that. These are just data for about 1988, 89, of ivory officially recorded as leaving different African countries. And you can see the southern nations, the poaching hasn't arrived, the tusks being taken there are significantly larger from those from the eastern and central African countries, which are down at this 4 kilogram ones. The average size of stuff going into the market in Singapore is about 4 to 5 kilograms. The most miraculous ones are these ivory coming out of Burundi. Burundi at this time was legally exporting 2,000 to 5,000 tusks a year, which by some genetic miracle was all produced by 5 elephants. And none of their elephants ever died, even though they were exporting thousands of tusks a year. And that gives you an index of just how corrupt the ivory market was. It was possible for this country to have legal certificates to say it could easily remove several thousand tusks from 5 elephants every year. Totally bonkers. Now, let's bring out our inner nerd and make some models for elephant populations. Just a simple harvesting model. We'll just assume we haven't got two sexes to begin with. One sex, we'll assume that it's Amboseli, it's settled down as female elephants at Amboseli. We'll harvest a random 2% of elephants per year. When we do that, the elephant population declines. Ultimately, 2% would hold it at a relatively low abundance, so supposedly that would be a sustainable harvest. If we stop harvesting it, it recovers. But it takes of the order of 100 years to recover. It doesn't instantly bounce back. Secondly, notice that as you harvest it at a constant 2% effort, the yield of ivory decreases because you've halved the size of the elephants, you end up with half the ivory yield. That relatively straightforward? Good. If you've got that, you're ahead of most of the economists who work on ivory and elephant, because they think if you harvest at a constant rate, you end up with the same number of elephants through time. And so economists, as you will have realized now, do not do population regulation. They just think everything keeps growing all the time, so you can harvest things at a much higher rate and they won't decline in abundance. So we're making progress. You could take this relationship between how far do we decrease the size of the population versus the yield and plot it out as if you were a fisheries biologist, which is a slightly more complicated way of looking at things. But this essentially says, if you don't harvest the population, it will settle down to something we might call a carrying capacity. As we harvest it at 0.25% a year, 0.5% a year, 1% a year, we will reduce the size of the population. So it'll be a sustainable level, but it'll be reduced by half. And we will have our maximum yield of ivory if we're taking about 1% a year. As we go up 2%, 3%, we'll eventually eradicate the population and it'll go extinct. But as you get a higher and higher take, you get a less and less yield because you've got less elephants to take that higher yield from. So we're now well ahead of the economists. You could use that to say how quickly will the population decline? If this is your percentage annual removal, how long will it take you to drive them extinct? If you take 10%, it'll take you 10% a year, it'll take you about 80 years to drive them extinct. If you take 5%, they may not go extinct, they'll just go to very low abundances. The black line is how long it takes you to halve the size of the population. So the bigger the exploitation level, the quicker it goes down. And what Richard said, well, Leakey said, can you get me the estimates of what the harvesting, what the poaching rate is inside Kenya's parks? And the rate inside Kenya's parks was about 18% in the 80s. And he said, we won't have elephants in 40 years if we let this continue. And that again said, let's light that bonfire and stop this happening. Now that's a dumb way to harvest them at random. Because if you're a poacher, you're much better off going for the ones with the biggest tusks. So what's the relationship? Well, what if we were to say the poachers were super smart, ahead of the economists, and took elephants with the biggest tusks? Well, we could plot out a graph that says, here's the age of elephants, here's the average tusk weight. What happened if we only let tusks of a certain size into the trade? Say, bigger than 50 kilograms, bigger than 40 kilograms, bigger than 20, down to our 4 kilograms. Notice if we're at 4 to 5 kilograms, we're taking very young males, and mainly quite young females. If we do that, our relationship between stock size and yield size changes. We now have this really crappy looking graph, which actually really does have two bumps. This is when we're taking males. This is when we switch to taking females, but mainly older, larger females. So we have many, many more elephants. We don't have many males, but we've got lots of females, and we hope those males that are left are able to mate with those. So we get a completely different yield of ivory if we only let tusks into the trade that are bigger than about 7 to 10 kilograms. But we were down at 4 kilograms, so we've got many less elephants, and we're also getting many lower yield. And indeed, if we compare the two curves, and here I've changed the axis so you can actually see it really is two bumps, so this is 90% of population size, 99%, 9%. The most important thing from this figure is if you harvest elephants by taking the ones with the biggest tusks, you get 10 times the yield than if you harvest them at random. And that again puts into play the pure nonsense that we hear coming out of the southern African countries, because they say, we need to harvest our elephants to get money to pay for conservation. So we're going to harvest them at random. If you harvest them at random to get money to pay for conservation, you're losing 90% of the money you could get if you just waited for them to die and pick the ivory up off the ground. So again, pure nonsense from relatively weak science. Now what happens to the population? If the poachers are being efficient and harvesting males more than females, as the relative population declines, what happens to the sex ratio? Well, obviously, take more males away from females, the ratio of males to females will get larger and larger. You've got less and less, you've got more and more females per male. This is on a log scale, so this is 10 females per male, this is 100 females per male. What do we see if we go and look at elephant populations? Well, one thing Joyce did was to go to different parks in a Land Rover, occasionally breaking down, using amboseli, an unpoached population as a control, you have about 3/4 of the adult population is female, about 1/4 is males, though very few of these will be old enough to reproduce yet. If we start going to other parks in East Africa, Kenya, Tanzania, Uganda, the proportion of males to females is often up to 100 to 200 to 1. That is a deeply distorted sex ratio. And so you have these massively distortions in the numbers of females to males. What does that do for the population? Well, again, you can make models of this where you have a sort of predator-prey in a sort of Freudian way, males searching for females, females in a population of females living in groups of different sizes. The bigger the groups of the females, the more isolated they are, and the harder it is for the males to find them. It's great when they do find them, but essentially, as this begins to happen, it's harder and harder for the males to find the females, and you'll stop getting reproduction in the females because there'll never be enough males to be able to find them and mate with them. Again, you can show that how that works in terms of the sex ratio. The bigger the sex ratio and the more the females are aggregated into group, the less chances that any of them get mated. And that would be a classic example of an alley effect distorting the shape of elephant populations. You could put that back into our model and say, okay, we'll put that alley effect in, let's harvest the population, and then let's stop harvesting it. At a certain point, when you stop harvesting, it just collapses anyway. The females are not being found by males, there's not enough males to go around, the thing will collapse. So that was a very good reason to try and stop the whole trade, and it was very effective. From about 1988, 89, CITES put a ban on elephants. This drew attention to the ivory being worthless. People would rather burn it than wear it. And for about 10, 15 years, we had a period of respite. And then, you know, just when you think, ah, we've solved all this, this is really quite good news, there was suddenly an increase again in the poaching. Part of this may have been the slight recovery we'd seen over that time period, but also a lot of it reflected changes in the market for ivory. And everybody said, this is because China has now got a much stronger economy and they're able to start buying ivory. And indeed, we would see really gory things like this, elephants with their faces chopped off to get the ivory and the tusks heading across to various locations around the world where they'd be carved into trinkets for tourists. Or, curiously, if you're in the Chinese military, if you give your commanding officer an ivory carving, you favor your chances of being promoted. So that's also another sort of dodgy use for ivory. And again, we found ourselves back in another battle, fighting to how do we keep elephants going. Lots of work showed that ivory was indeed going across the Indian Ocean into Vietnam, through Singapore, Malaysia, into and then into China. But as I'll show you in a minute, that's an artifact of the way we were looking. So by this time, we had better data coming in than elephants. So Kate and I started looking at different ways of looking at this and put together a database. There was a database that IUCN and people have been putting together for elephants, but we felt it was incomplete, and in a slightly paranoid way, they wouldn't let us look at it. I was like, okay, well, we'll make our own database. We know where all the information is. So we made our own one, and we're happy to share it with anybody. What that showed us straight away is that there are many less elephants left in West Africa, increasingly less left in Central Africa, still quite a lot then in East Africa, this is about sort of 2010, and many still in Southern Africa. Everybody sort of started to do that to sort of try and say, well, how many African elephants are left? And could we do different ways of counting them? If we put together the data we were really confident with, people felt there were about 400,000 elephants for sure in Africa. Maybe there was another 82,000, and maybe as many as another 200,000 to get us up to of the order of 750,000, or 250,000. We were kind of skeptical about that, and so we really wanted to look at our database and sort of say, well, can we put together a database, look at all the 100-odd places where people have been studying and counting elephants, and then fit some sort of model across Africa, fitting it to each individual population, dividing them into forest elephants and savanna elephants, which are different species, estimate the sort of simple parameters of a simple model, and then do two things. One, try and look at the rate at which different populations were being poached, which would give us an indication of how many tusks were being removed, get information on the tusks entering the trade, which would then, the ratio of those two things would give an indication of what proportion of the ivory that's being poached is actually located and confiscated, and what's the long-term impact of that going to be on elephants. So, one of the most useful pieces of information we got is collected by the African Elephant Research Group. They spend a lot of time going around looking for dead elephants and classify elephants as either having died naturally or having been poached. And so they produce an index that's called the Pike Index. And it's deeply confusing because the organization monitoring it is called Mike. And they produce a statistic called a PIKE, but Mike collects data on illegally killed elephants. Monitoring illegally killed elephants is Mike. PIKE is the proportion of illegally killed elephants. So it's essentially poached elephants divided by poached elephants and natural mortality. Now these PIKE numbers seem to be increasing through time, which was worrying. More and more illegally killed elephants were being located. I find it frustrating to lose an index like Pike, so it was like, well, let's do the simple algebra and convert the Pike into a proportion of elephants harvested, which simple exercise algebraically, because then I can relate that back to all the calculations I'd done before of how does the population respond to different percentage harvesting rates. So I can convert a pike into an H, a harvesting index. I can also quite simply take data for different African populations, look at the pike index, and then look at the change in size, the change in the growth rate. So this is the growth rate, not the population size. Once the pike gets above about 50%, the population will decline. If it's above 50%, below 50%, the population will potentially keep growing. And if we do that, dividing all the sites into ones from West Africa, Central Africa, East Africa, and Southern Africa, the declining ones are very much West and Central Africa. The ones initially are in East and Southern Africa. Now, the curious thing is that the Mike people think the pike represents a harvesting level, and they believe that the sustainable harvest level should be of the order of 6%. Now, I showed you earlier that if you get above 3%, you will drive elephants extinct, and that's because they've talked to economists and forgotten about including the way the populations are regulated. So they feel that anything below 5 is sustainable. It is sustainable, but it will reduce the population to 1% of what it would be if you didn't harvest it. So again, they're deeply confused about this. So they think above 5 population increases, it will increase, but very, very slowly. If you go back to my figure, those 3 and 4% bring it down to a very, very low level. Stop harvest that level, it'll bounce back, but you are overexploiting it if you believe this curve. So what do? We then collated all the data that they wouldn't let us have, but we found ways of getting it for all these different sites, and then fitted a model to it to try and get at these other figures. So we can take a really simple model that just says the number of elephants next year will be the growth rate of the elephant populations minus the proportion harvested, and the proportion harvested will be given to us by the pike numbers. We will look at pike numbers for wherever we've got them, and then we'll average them locally and produce a sort of what's our best estimate of the pike rate here if we've got data for two sites within 100 kilometers on that. And we'll do that across Africa for most of the first 15 years of this, the first 12 years of this century. Now, it gives you quite an accurate fit. The best fit has a sort of background mortality rate of about 95%, which would tie in with Amboseli, and a population growth rate of about 1.06, which would tie in with Amboseli. Now, this looks messy, but it essentially says, it's color-coded, the big populations, this is population size, are all in southern, and at this time, East Africa. They're not declining very rapidly, though we're beginning to see some declines. West Africa has small populations, and they're gradually all dying out. And indeed, if you aggregate those together, this is the estimated numbers of tusks removed. So blue is Central Africa, they're mainly forest elephants. From about 2001 through to 2010, we see, and this is sort of aggregate, that this is each year, of the order of 20,000 tusks removed in some places. Black is East Africa, this huge increase of poaching you've heard about as it moves into Kenya and Tanzania. Red is Southern Africa, beginning to take off there. Green is West Africa, it's not particularly large because there's no elephants left. And if you then convert that into the amount of ivory seized overall, it suggests that on average, despite intensive anti-poaching efforts, we're only capturing about 5% of the ivory that's actually poached. A pathetically small amount for huge amounts of money spent. Again, you can show by region the cumulative amount of ivory. East Africa was getting more and more taken off. Central Africa, huge amounts. It's only beginning to increase in Southern Africa. There's almost nothing left in West Africa. You could then say, well, what's the relative population sizes through time? Just we know they're all different, but we'll assume they all start at 1,000 just to indicate the Southern African populations continue to grow because they're being poached at a relatively low rate. The East African ones were growing and are now beginning to decline. The Central African ones, the West African ones, had hardly any growth and are in deep dive. And the forest elephants are also beginning to decline rapidly. Now, that's deeply worrying. We could say, well, what's that going to do? How do we stop that? We can light some more fires, and indeed, you can go to New York, you can go to Washington, you can go to big cities and see ivory being crunched up to try and stop it. They burn ivory every year in Nairobi National Park now. But we could look forward and say, let's take that model, because we know it provides a pretty good fit to the data. We know the thing it's most sensitive to is that pike, the proportion of elephants illegally killed. Let's have four different scenarios and look out from the time of the CITES meeting last year to 2025 and say there's four different things you could do. You could have a total ivory ban that stopped all elephant hunting in its tracks, the ideal thing you'd like to do. That's the orange line. If you do that, this is our estimate of total elephant numbers, which we think is no more than 400,000. If you stop the ivory trade in its tracks, the elephants would recover slowly up to 2025. You might end up with many young elephants with back up towards 500,000, 600,000 elephants. If you have business as usual, just taking for each point the pike value it's had, just set those as a set of random numbers and run them forward into the future, so the business as usual, elephants might have a vague chance of recovering. If you were to harvest at the maximum sustainable yield, obviously if it's sustainable, you'd end up with exactly the same elephants in the future as you have now. If there's an increase in the poaching, you begin to get a slow decline. But the devil of that is in the details, because we can split it up into different regions and say, business as usual, you're going to lose all the elephants that you have remaining in the Central African forests and in West Africa. You'll have a steady decline in the West, and it only increases because business as usual is not a lot of poaching in Southern Africa. If you have an increase in poaching, everything declines, and even Southern Africa begins to decline. Obviously, if you have a CITES ban, you get a recovery in East Africa. You get very little of indication of a recovery of the forest elephants, and in the West, you get a steady and massive and increasing increase in Southern Africa. So the recovery you're seeing has a huge geographical signature and will occur at different rates in different places. And in many ways explains the tensions between the Southern African countries, who feel they have too many elephants and there should be a trade, and the East African and West African countries who say, if this trade continues, we will not have elephants anymore. So that puts the elephants in a really scary dilemma. How are we going to keep conserving them? One way would be to get revenue from the tourism. If we go to Amboseli, we can calculate the cost of all the ivory on the elephants in Amboseli. You can calculate the tourist revenue for people coming to see the elephants in Amboseli. The tourism revenue for Amboseli every year is 10 times their value as ivory at the maximum ivory prices. So elephants for tourism in some locations could be a spectacular way to generate revenue. But it requires elephants that have worked with people and are relatively habituated. That's not going to work everywhere. The other thing we have for regulating the trade is CITES, the Convention for International Trade in Endangered Species. And this is the organization that decides whether we should have a ban on the sale of ivory, ban on sale of tuna, ban on sale of pangolins, etc. It meets every 3 years, looks at data of species in the trade to decide what to do. And it does spend a huge amount of time, almost a quarter of its time, discussing elephants. And that massively divides the nations who go, particularly the Southern African nations and the African and the nations that trade in ivory from those who don't trade in the ivory. And that creates a tension that affects all the other decisions that CITES made. So we thought it would be interesting to look at the CITES data for elephants, even though we know it only represents of the order of 5% of the amount in trade for elephants. There's very good books that can introduce you to CITES. These are two of my favorites. But there's also now a CITES database online you could go to and download data. It's a kind of a clunky database. So it brought tears to my eyes quite a lot when I was working on it. But CITES, as I say, is this thing we have for monitoring trade. So let's look at a couple of things about CITES. These CITES imports into two nations, where we are now, the United States and China. And they tell you that CITES is doing an interesting job in monitoring the trade. CITES was set up in 1976. It classifies species under four categories. If you're Appendix 1, there is no legal trade in you. If you're Appendix 2, there's limited trade. And at Appendix 3, there are beginning to be constraints on trade. Appendix 3, essentially, the constraints are determined where the country that the species is exported from. Appendix 2 is both the import and export country that put the constraints on it. Appendix 1 is absolutely no trade. So you can see, as CITES was set up, trade of anything, all species into the US, goes up to about 10,000 transactions per year in Appendix 1 and Appendix 2 species. These are cumulatively added up, with about 1,000 trades a year in Appendix 3 species. What's happening in China is a more steady increase, and this, of course, reflects the political and economic changes in China. There's a steady increase in trade that jumps up as China becomes a greater economic power. But evil China is importing 10% of endangered species compared to the US. And that's not a figure you see bandied around much. Part of that may reflect the relative efficiency of the fish and wildlife agencies in the different places. But this says to me, don't let's point the finger too heavily at China until we've seen what's going on in the US. And indeed, if we go to elephants, these are elephants imported into the US. These are elephants imported into big bad China. This is, and there's this switch, because elephants were originally on Appendix 2. When the ivory was burnt, they go onto Appendix 1. So there's no longer any elephants on Appendix 2 until the Southern African nations overturn that ban. But this is the amount of ivory and elephant products entering the US. This is the amount going into China. It's actually a fifth the amount going into the US. And that I find deeply disconcerting, that we all think China's the problem when a huge part of the problem is at home. So one of the things Kate and I have been doing is working with a rather extraordinary group of women who formed an organization called Elephants DC to go state by state and call for a ban on ivory products for sale, particularly by antique dealers in the different states of the US, by antique dealers and jewelers, because there's still a ton of ivory somehow finding its way into the US. So that suggests there's plainly a lot of ivory also going west. It's easy to trace it going this way, but why are we missing out seeing so much of it going in the other direction? And that's a wonderful challenge for somebody to go and work on. We were having a meeting just around here in Tanzania in July, early in July, about the 4th of July. And I was talking to a really super guy, Dale, having a beer, talking about the Serengeti. We were talking about ivory poaching. And I said, you know, I think there's a lot going into the US. And he said, yeah, we're beginning to look at that. But this whole ivory poaching thing is still going on behind the scenes. It was the last time I saw him. He was assassinated on the way to the airport a week later. So these people are playing serious games. As I'm so curious, I couldn't resist looking at other aspects of CITES. So I thought, well, let's take a nation that has a huge trade, but is distributing stuff internationally, and that's Singapore, and let's just look at the trade that CITES monitors going through Singapore. So these are data for birds, mammals, reptiles, plants, invertebrates, and fish. So this is all trade going through Singapore, just an example of one nation, but a major trading nation. When I looked at the actual names of these species, these are from all over the world. This gives you the magnitude of trade in wildlife. It's growing, except it's collapsing. That's the same as that elephant graph I showed you of elephants being overexploited, except this is for whole communities of organisms. And indeed, when we split it up between birds, these are birds mainly from Southeast Asia, but also from Africa a lot, and South America. This is a classic overexploitation graph. Whole communities of birds are being overexploited for trade, whole communities of mammals, plants. This doesn't include any timber and forest products in CITES. They can't keep up with it. Reptiles, corals, massively overexploited. and increasingly the fish somehow look dodgy, but we have different sets of data for collecting fish. That suggests to me that trade is absolutely destroying biodiversity. Everything we see in detail for elephants is happening broad brush for whole communities of species. And no one is paying attention to it. It's really scary. Well, we're beginning to pay attention to it. So you think, that's interesting. CITES should be doing more about that. And my initial temptation was to say, CITES is deeply flawed. Why are they not doing more about this? Yet when you talk to the people, they really knew a lot about what's going on. And then you realize, but there's only about 10 of them. How come there's so few people? So it made me ask, how is CITES funded? It's the organization that deals with the trade in every other species on the planet. It doesn't deal in slavery, though it is connected with the wildlife trade, is as connected to the slave trade as it is to trade in arms and drugs. Those things are all intimately coupled together. CITES is probably, along with Interpol, best geared to monitor that. What is the annual budget for CITES? It is $5 million. We have people working on Wall Street who get cranky and pissy if their annual bonus is less than $5 million. Yeah. Some of them, heaven forbid, might be trustees here or at Princeton, and that money will go to a good cause. But $5 million to monitor the global trade in all the non-voting spirits, species that supply ecosystem services to us all is, I find, deeply pathetic. The average cost for the nations that contribute is $25,000. That's the cost of a graduate student. It's deeply pathetic. So we need to find ways of empowering CITES. That way they would have a better computer database that wouldn't drive me nuts, but it would give them significantly more power to monitor what is arguably at the center of most of the corrupt trade in the world. Okay. Essentially, this has occurred because the world in which we set up CITES in the 1970s doesn't exist anymore. It's a much more complicated international trading world, but that nonetheless, CITES is massively underfunded, and we need to find ways of taxing the trade to put more money into CITES to monitor the trade. And we also, bizarrely, need to get CITES to spend less time talking about elephants and having a set of relatively simple mathematical tools that would allow them to easily classify species and different appendices. And I'm not going to talk about that because I've run out of time. So what have I tried to tell you? I've told you that elephants are in a lot of trouble, that they are an amazing species. You know, I love working on birds, but I deeply love working on elephants. I've learned so much from working about elephants. That we exploit them is, I find, a deep tragedy, particularly as we exploit them for essentially little bits of jewelry and pathetic little statues. Those were wonderful when several generations carved one tusk into something for some leader in India, but when you're just cranking them out for tourists to take home and break on the plane, that's a real waste of a species. To understand how that species responds to exploitation, we need to understand its biology, but we also need to put together these sort of databases, fit simple models to them, extrapolate, and look at what's happening and how organized and disorganized the trade is to deal with that. And the scary thing is once you start looking at the international database for elephants and how they enter trade, you discover that most things entering into trade are massively overexploited. And we have a relatively short time left before we can do anything about that. Otherwise, there's going to be nothing to trade. So on that cheerful note, I will leave you. Thank you so much. I'll only take happy questions. Yes.
Space that they had before. to migrate, to find food, to, we're basically putting them in these little reservations the way we've done other humans, and that's not sustainable for them either. From other lectures and documentations that I've seen, you know, sometimes thinking that we just have a park isn't also the solution, because animals need to migrate, they need to do that to you know, not just one animal, but different animals need to sort of, so, how do you deal with that?
Again, that's going to be, it's relates to some of the things I talked about. I think yesterday's lecture, I skipped over this slide, but this is essentially the human impact on African elephant range up to 2010. Going forward to 2050, the green areas are what's left for elephant. Everything else is converted to agricultural land. To feed humans, we're inevitably going to convert tons of land into agricultural land unless we can improve the efficiency of agriculture. And tragically, that doesn't mean growing organic corn and organic beans. It means massively intensive, genetically modified. Well, that's going to be the only way that you're going to be able to grow enough people to feed those, grow enough food to feed people and save the land for the other species. If we go to the diet of sort of all organic, living in sort of a happy bliss with our food, there will be no land left for anything else. And that's a sort of, again, as I said, this talk will be about moral dilemmas. That's one where we've got a very mixed message, because this whole having organic food and having biodiversity are never going to be a compatible argument. So I worry about that. The thing I worry about more was your first question, is why are we spending all this money on space? Why does our vice president want to have footprints on the moon? We can do that in 1,000 years' time. It's not going to go away. We learn very little of use to humanity from anything that's come out of the space program, other than the satellites that look back down on the Earth and tell us how the Earth is changing. The rest is for the egos of a bunch of physicists whose brains would be better used looking at these problems on Earth. They're harder problems than rocket science. Yeah,
I have a bigger question.
Yeah.
Which is, I was struck by your account of how there's at least the discovered imports of ivory to the US are actually still bigger than the imports to China, if I got you correctly. And I have been understanding this the trend, the new poaching that took off, as you mentioned, from the 90s, as correlating exactly with the rise of China, the investment, Chinese investment in Africa, Chinese people in Africa, trade in Africa. It seems a very close correlation. Well, how then would you explain what is this trade in the US? Who is buying? And I feel like I have a handle on who is buying in China and why. They have crazy reasons.
Yeah.
And maybe crazy reasons. But what about the US? Who is doing this?
Well, I mean, this. Lots of it, I say, is going to antique dealers, gun handles, the major states that we haven't been able to get any traction for a ban on ivory are the states where the NRA says, no, that will affect the sale of antique guns with ivory handles. And we go, well, you know, what the f-? The second thing that goes to your point, yeah, if the stuff coming into the US is totally flat and you're looking for a relationship between increase in poaching, then the only place you're going to get a correlation is between the line going up for China and the increase. But that doesn't mean that the US isn't still importing a ton of stuff. And it's like, huh, I want to know where that stuff's going. And as I say, what we seem to be having to do at the moment is to go state to state and talk to different people and see where the resistance is in different states. Another part of this is, you know, some of the most marvelous people out there are the US Fish and Wildlife people, who do a phenomenally good job on locating it. So this is stuff that's recovered under CITES, but they've got a very, very high capture rate. The people in China are not as efficient as that. We don't know what their efficiency is. So there could be much more going into China that isn't being detected by CITES. So that would also distort this. But I just find it disconcerting that when you look at the overall figures, there is as much, there's more going into the US than there is going into China. That has then got to be modified. But how different are those detection levels? And this is all on a log scale. They could be 10 times different, and there would still be more stuff going into the US than into China.
You are saying that there is a huge amount of new, fresh reports going to the US, despite...
We don't know if it's newly fresh reports. Well, it's coming in. There isn't a huge amount of antique ivory being moved around between continents. So I suspect that lots of this is fresh ivory. And the last 2 years, there's been a huge ivory crush in New York. There's now one in Philadelphia, one in Denver, one in Los Angeles. There is tons and tons of stuff coming in that's freshly carved ivory that they've confiscated, US Fish and Wildlife, and they're crushing at these things. But I thought, oh, well, that's it. That'll be it for 10 years. It was as much the next year as it was the previous year. So that's a lot coming in.
And this is despite this widely talked about ban, Obama and Xi Jinping got together and said they're banning.
That's had the effect of slowing down, ironically, what's going into China. And trying to kill the trade in China has actually begun to bring down what's going in there. And so I've got to brave the CITES database to get the last 2 or 3 years data. But if you look at this, it does look as if China is slowing down since they made that agreement. The US, ironically, isn't showing that slowdown.
How is that possible?
That's what I want to know. It's money. Yeah, it's money. And so what's driving it? And as I said, the costs of asking the wrong questions were met by my friend. This is not a nice bunch of people we're dealing with in these trades. However honest your elderly antique dealer looks, there's some very dodgy people supplying them.
That's related to my question. So it's clear that we're getting this funding for savings, but what about on the ground, the corruption, for example, someone's starting to ask those questions and it's assassinated? You've been working at it for the last 10 years. Can you talk a little bit more about how we can fight the corruption?
It's tricky. All of us who work there get death threats, which is interesting because it creates a dilemma. Where do you put that on your annual report to the dean? It's like community outreach. but it's sort of which ones do you take seriously, and which ones are they just trying to sort of strong arm you? Plainly, I'm going to be much more cautious after what happened to my friend. Other friends who's been working in against the hunting lobby, he can't go to Tanzania anymore. So it's a question of how do you expose corruption without endangering yourself, and how do you do it like I've tried to do here by saying we can't just blame China. And we can't blame Tanzania, because if I look at these graphs from where the data's coming from, I'm as worried about what's going on in the US as I am in any of those other locations. So it's like saying, well, here's the information. Could we empower CITES as a larger organization to be a bigger organization and get in and expose corruption? And could we be honest about how connected it is to things like the arms trade and the drugs trade, both of which are run by pretty scary people as well? Yeah. We haven't really detected that. Quite a lot of what's going into CITES, which is partly why I chose Singapore, that there isn't a lot of live trade going through Singapore. Lots, and that's why I said didn't specifically look at stuff coming into the US other than in this early figure, because a lot of it is stuff originally coming in for zoos, which would be live stuff, which has to be registered for CITES. Similarly, huge amounts of primates are brought in under CITES for medical research. And so it includes those things as well as dishonest, or less honest uses, or stuff that's for sort of jewelry and frivolous uses. So again, it's disentangling And the CITES database does give you that information, but it's, as I say, it's a really clunky database to work with. No, I mean the countries that have got the huge multinational parks would be across from the Kruger into Mozambique. That seems to be working quite well. I mean, the problem is that there's still a cull of elephants in Kruger. So you open up the fence, the Mozambique that some of the elephants will spill out into Mozambique, which will be good because otherwise they would stay in Kruger and be culled. But Kruger has a policy that they want a certain number of elephants. So if they've gone into Mozambique, they won't be killed, culled in Kruger. We've got people, we have elephants moving from Serengeti into the Maasai Mara across the border between Kenya and Tanzania. And we've had elephants from Amboseli going up into Kilimanjaro, and it's gone either way. Whenever the poaching's bad in Kenya, the elephants come down into the Serengeti, and our numbers of elephants there have gone up as the sort of poaching's increased and their hassle has increased around the Mara. But whenever sometimes we've had Amboseli elephants with collars on them have gone into Kilimanjaro, and professional hunters have said, oh, there's a nice elephant. I don't know why it's wearing a necklace, but let's shoot it. And it's like, well, guys, you've got a license for a specific elephant. You shouldn't be up taking elephants that are long-term research animals. So again, there's both the poaching and there's the hunting lobby to sort of wrestle with there. So certainly there are transboundary issues, and we're trying to look at ways of dealing with those. In general, opening up and letting the elephants move around, and other species as well, has been beneficial.
I'm curious about in southern Africa, where the populations are higher, are there any troublesome impacts on habitat that we need to worry about as well, either for elephants or for other species?
As your elephant numbers build up, a huge number of elephant researchers are looking at this whole business of human-elephant conflict. And you can have elephants in an area. You could fence them in, which I'm not at all keen on, but that stops them coming out and eating people's crops. And if people try and stop those crops, they may well get killed by the elephants because the elephants in the dark just don't know who's attacking them and will just sort of swing out. As we go back through those maps, where is it? This is only, if you're going to have to convert Africa to a farm, and have the elephants in those small green areas, all around those areas, you're going to have problems with elephants coming out and raiding your crops. So people have been looking at better ways to persuade elephants to stay in parks, which includes things like putting chili on posts around them, because elephants don't really like chili, putting recordings of bees, because elephants don't like bees. They get very nervous about getting stung inside their nose, which is the most painful place to be stung. So people are looking at ways to try and convince elephants that they're better off in where they are. But elephants are super smart things. The older they are, they do remember. And if you go into a drought, the older individuals will remember where they went for water when there was a drought. And that'll just take them out of the park and create. So it works great when it's rained a lot. And there's lots of food in the parks. When there's less food in the parks, they will wander around and start taking crops that are even more valuable in a drought because the crops are growing at a slower rate. So it's finding ways to deal with those conflicts is a major agenda for people working on elephants.